When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We're recording this on Election Day morning. We don't know what has happened as you're listening to this. It's going to come out Wednesday morning. Maybe we should record a couple of bumpers. Like, you know, there's the jubilant one. You know, there's the stiff upper lip one. There's the political limbo one. Here we are. Happy Election Day. We need a word for the eve, the day after, right? Eve, we need it like the day after Christmas Day. Like, those are important moods that Eve captures for the day before, but there's a certain move to New Year's Day, day after Christmas, day after Thanksgiving. And certainly this is like a reduction and concentration. It's like an extract of those feelings tomorrow, depending on how it goes.
It is. I was saying this morning that I feel like my heart is half hopeful and half that video that's gone around this year of the Grinch like screaming at the end of a yoga class. Like, take a deep breath, and he just lets it out.
However this pans out, and whatever your political persuasions you are, Biden, this will either be a celebratory exhaling or a diversion, distraction, reprieve from whatever else may be happening. So we're thinking of you preemptively. It reminds me of Whitman writing Crossing Brooklyn Ferry and trying to imagine people reading his poems from 100 years from now. Nice effort, but he got it totally wrong, which I think is right. Where could we be right now? He's like, and you too will be looking at all these ships with their masts. I'm like, oh yeah, he didn't know about steam engines. That was a big miss on his part. No Raymond Kurzweil. Was Walt Whitman. Anyway, now we're really off and running, so let's do a break and I'll try to corral whatever is happening.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia Senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at leighbardugothefamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
We're doing adaptation wish list today. We were just doing a little pre-show, pre-planning, and both of us, I think, had the thought that given the number of adaptations that have happened over the last 5 years, that we might actually have to, like, you know, scrounge and scrape four good ideas. And I think we both found that putting ourselves in the mood, sitting down with a piece of paper and maybe like looking at your bookshelves. I'm not sure how you did this, Rebecca. I sort of started there. And I got eight that I would be thrilled to be announced tomorrow in about 6 minutes. And then I stopped. And you went even a little bit further. I'm not sure we can get through today. But tell me about the experience of like drumming up ideas.
I had saved this task for this morning for Election Day because I knew that
I
would want some distractions. And that's exactly what I did. I was having coffee, looking around the living room, sort of glancing at my bookshelves. And I really only keep the books that I'm attached to in some way. So that was its own kind of filter. But it took me, I think, about 4 minutes of looking at bookshelves, be like, oh, all these would be so good. And then, of course, like those jogged memories of other books that I liked, but that I don't have anymore. And I took like one glance down my reading log from the last couple of years just to see if there was anything that like I read digitally or listened to that, you know, wasn't on my shelves, but that I would want to note. And I have like 15 and I think I could have kept going. And I didn't put them in any kind of order. So we're just going to wild card go.
I didn't either.
There's so many good options.
I guess the other thing we didn't talk about before in planning this was we're kind of going off our recall of what we know their adaptations coming for out there. At least I did. Like, I didn't pick anything I knowingly, but I also wasn't doing research about if someone's, I'm assuming most of these, the options are owned by someone at some point, and that's different than a series getting greenlit. Like, I'm trying to think of, well, like, you know, like Underground Railroad is much further along, but there's even things down the pike, like the Amazon series or Asimov's Foundation or like anything I knew. There was something I left off, but then I also didn't go check to see if there was, you know, something coming. Because these are such that I would remember hearing more news about. In fact, though, yesterday I had to cross, I had a pre-list because I have a little bit of a shared wheelhouse zone here, things that I think we both maybe would have picked. And foremost among those was the things they carried, which just yesterday was announced, going to get turned into a series starring Tom Hardy and Pete Davidson and others.
That's great
there you
news,
go.
And I had not heard that.
Yeah.
I had
limited
to remind...
series.
Okay.
So was that on your list at all?
It wasn't.
Have you thought about that?
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but man, I'm excited about that now. I started this morning thinking about My Sister, the Serial Killer, which I think is also a shared wheelhouse. And then I was like, wait, I feel like maybe we talked about that getting optioned. And I Googled, and indeed it did. So I'm excited about that. I'm like crying already just thinking about the things they carry. That audio, I listened to it. I've read it a couple times. I think we talked about it on the show when Bryan Cranston did the audio a few years back. I had to like pull the car over. I was crying so hard. So that's going to be a watch it in the privacy of my own home in a couple years moment, I guess.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Tim O'Brien's, I think, you know, Slender's masterwork about a group, a squad of American soldiers in Vietnam, kind of the anti-apocalypse now, you know, this triumphalist, you know, kind of like, you know, Apocalypse Now is Heart of Darkness set in Vietnam and sort of grandiose and over the top, you know, Ride of the Valkyries with Robert Duvall looking over the thing and Kurtz and the whole thing. Like it's kind of a, you know, and Sheen is doing drugs. It's a very manic, over the top fever dream where the things they carried is, I wouldn't even know. I didn't prepare to talk about it at all, but it's really a character study about the relationships of these people in an unusual, to say the least, circumstance. And I think a helpful bromide for most representations of Vietnam, especially, but also even the kind of like less jingoistic, but still maybe romanticized version of like Comrades in Arms, like even stuff I like Band of Brothers, right? It's Band of Brothers is, I love Band of Brothers, the book. I read the book in the series, but it's actually fairly uncomplicated, right? There's not a whole lot of there's a little bit between Cobb and some of the things, but like I think the things they carried is like group therapy, like the lessons of like someone who's come back to think about the experience and really thinking about the relationships between them and what their experience meant and what it didn't mean. Welcome to this, the Things They Carried podcast. I'm your host, Jeff O'Neill. Anyway, that's the only one I had to strike. There probably could be some other options or things in the works, but I don't know. Out there, Rebecca, I'm going to throw it to you.
Oh,
I don't know
goodness.
Where you want to start. I'm helpful to start. I guess, well, I'll start because I think this is one we might would have picked. And I don't really have, these aren't in an order of what I would pick. Like if I had a couple of cards to play, like this will be created. But I think this one fits the, I really want there to be a good adaptation of a work by this author. And I don't think there is one yet. And that's Toni Morrison. I don't think that's come as anyone's surprise here. There is a version of Beloved, which I think is not as bad as it gets a rap for, but I do not think it will stand. I don't think that's maybe the right pick to come out. I'm going with Paradise. I think it's the most cinematic of them. The opening sequence, they killed the white girl first. Morrison is wonderful at opening lines, but this is a very sort of action movie, kind of a thriller sequence of this. I don't want to give away too much, but people going through a place to hunt these women, and then you go back and forth, and it's historical and has a very interesting ending, and I think there's a lot that could be done there. I kind of ran through the rest of the Morrison thinking, you know, is there any one of them? What I've learned is any book I've ever read can be done well. Some may be harder than others. So all of these are possible. I'm not saying any of them are impossible. But I think Paradise, there's a very recognizable setting, has very well-drawn characters, very visual action, where the action of something like Tar Baby or Sula or Beloved, for that matter, is internal a lot of times. So Paradise by Toni Morrison, I think, is my... I need a flag in the ground for Morrisonia on screen, and I think I would start there. Rebecca, thoughts about that?
I love that. As you know, that's my favorite Toni Morrison.
That's your favorite, I know. I'm preaching to the choir here, I know.
And I think that could work as a movie, or I could see it as a limited-run HBO situation.
Yeah.
Because you have... you know, the women in the old convent and the sort of repetition and bouncing back and forth that's happening there. I didn't even think about Toni Morrison, I think because my brain is just like, it's impossible to do her well. But I think you're correct that Paradise could be done well. It has the best shot, I think, of being a good and interesting adaptation. And I would love to see that. I'm just assuming that the Gilead books, or at least the first one, is one that we are both going to long for forever.
You know, I decided ultimately that I'm okay. I'm good with Gilead. You know, after I listened to some of the Ethan Hawke, and I'm not sure what the movie could give me that the book doesn't, since it is a book of language, right? Like letters written. True. Like the performance, I would watch it. I think I would maybe prefer it as like a one-man stage play, you know, in Ethan Hawke mode, or some, you know, where the performance is more key. Again, I would watch the living corn out of a Gilead adaptation, but I actually find that the value add may be not as great to me as some of these others.
I share that as well. Like the books are just perfect, you know, and years ago, I think we were just talking about it offline this week, we did a dream casting together of the books, and you mentioned Joaquin Phoenix to play Jack, and that just resonated so perfectly.
That holds. That was a good call. That tweet aged well.
It's a really, really good call, and I think I would love the chance to see him embody that character.
Right.
But I'm totally fine if I just have to imagine that world in my brain forever.
I think of those books, though. You're right, though, that Jack is the most cinematic. There's a lot more moving around. You got the city, and you've got some of the
romantic,
trying to meet up shenanigans. You know, like we said, that that opening sequence of Jack is like, it's a walk and talk in a graveyard with a threat of racial violence. But otherwise, it's exactly like The West Wing. So other than that, okay, so Paradise, Toni Morrison, that's my, I don't know. I don't know if it's the one I want the most, but it's maybe the one I need to be the most, if that distinction makes any difference.
Interesting. I think I just went for stuff I thought would be really fun.
That's fine. There's no rules here.
On screen, yeah. And I'm just gonna pick one off my list. Yeah. I love we love, both of us, a gang gets back together kind of story.
Yes.
And these are two contenders. I would be happy to see either of them, but they feel to me like they go together. So either or both, of Maine by J. Courtney Sullivan or Seating Arrangements by Maggie Shipstead. Maine is set over the course of a summer where three generations of women are living together in the families, like sort of running down beach house. All kinds of family drama things happen. It would make a great 8-episode HBO series. And Seating Arrangements is set over one wedding weekend, I think like in Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket, somewhere like that. Something very WASPy, and dramatic things happen and ridiculous things happen. And I imagine it as like not quite the Wedding Crashers. It's not as funny as like the Wedding Crashers vibe. It's more of a drama than a comedy, but there are really funny moments. And I would like to see people in their, you know, like critter shorts with their cardigans tied around their shoulders, having ridiculous social interactions with each other. I just like that setup of families or groups of friends, like in a compressed time, in a compressed time or a compressed space with each other running up against all their stuff. But I think that's probably a movie.
So. Yeah, I think you're right. Though that it seems to me that particular milieu has been squeezed out. Like you need to throw on a thriller or a murder in the middle of that to get it made. No, I'm serious. Like or like an arson. You need Little Fires Everywhere or Big Little Lies. Like if you take either of those and take out like the crime, you have one of these books, right? And for some reason, those get squeezed. If you need to go more towards comedy or satire or more towards thriller, this middle tier doesn't seem, maybe there's space for it, maybe not, but it is interesting to me to that literary sort of like upscale commercial fiction piece that's not a thriller kind of has got blown away. Like the movie version I'm thinking of is like, it's not a good movie, but I saw it at a time where I wanted to be more of an adult than I was, and you know, maybe still am. But like, did you ever see the movie Indian Summer? Do you remember that movie?
Oh, no.
So it's a group of adults that go back to the summer camp that they went to every summer. It's in your wheelhouse, and it's 90s. Okay. You may have been a little young for it. This might be a good hangover movie for you to find sometime where the stakes are very low and you're just sort of sitting there letting it wash over you.
It's a
getting the band back together. There's fraught stuff they've got to resolve. Adam Arkin plays the grizzled camp counselor that they're going back to see. Has almost no one you care about in it, actually. That kind of relationship and relationship only kind of a series doesn't seem to have much That's purchase true. Right now, right. And I don't know why. So we've got space for one. I'm not. Right. I'm interested.
I have
in that.
A pick that ups the ante a little bit.
Go. We'll snake draft it. One for me, two for you.
Yeah, Wild Game by Adrienne Brodjer was.
I don't remember this book.
It's a big memoir that came out a couple years ago, or it got a lot of buzz. Bananas memoir. The subtitle could be like, "And my life with a mother who has no boundaries." So, Adrienne's. It's appalling, but it would be great on TV. So, when she was a kid, her parents were best friends with this other couple, and they would go on vacation together. And like, her parents had a beach house, and the other couple would come over to the beach house, and there was just all of this like camaraderie between the couples. And one night, her mom comes in to tuck her into bed. She's like 12 at the time, and confides to 12-year-old Adrienne that the husband in the other couple, who's kind of this like dashing, rugged outdoorsman who can do all the things figure, has kissed her. And she is thrilled. And for years, like a decade, Adrienne Brodjer's mother carries on a relationship with the husband in the other couple, and they do this like right under the noses of their spouses in these shared spaces with child Adrienne sort of running. What's the word I'm looking for? Like not diversion, but sort of like running interference. That's it. Running interference for them.
Yeah. Interference.
Like helping create distractions, or like making sure that they can get away to the little cottage where they're going to go do what people who are having affairs do without the other spouses knowing. And it's like not a thing that a 12-year-old kid should be involved in at all. But she has no sense of this when she's 12, because she just feels so special that her mom has confided in her and made her like her confidant and buddy in getting this to happen, her co-conspirator. And as she grows up, she gets some perspective on how inappropriate and troubling all of this is. And she falls in love with the son of the other couple.
What? Come on.
Mm-hmm. And it, like, and he doesn't know about this relationship, like, for a long time. And it's bananas. It was a great memoir. I read it in one sitting on a flight. It's hard to recommend because there's so much of it is bananas, but it would make for really good TV.
That sounds like good. So that's a TV show.
I think that's a TV show. I think it's like HBO or AMC, somebody who can do some edgy stuff.
Gotcha. Okay.
Today's episode is brought to you by TorBooks. So if you are a fan of epic fantasy, if you're a fan of Scott Lynch and or Joe Abercrombie, but you want something a little different, you want a hero who's like a bit of a mess, then The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan is for you. In it, Academy dropout slash disgraced noble heir Lacan Cordova's life is in shambles. All he's got going for him is, one, he is a card sharp of considerable skill, and two, a lot of, maybe potentially a little too much, wine. So they're, you know, those are the positives. So when the bizarre murder of his father robs him of even the off chance of redemption, Lacan decides to make amends another way. He's going to unravel the mystery behind the killing, even if it takes him to the underbelly of Sofrona, a city of danger, secrets, and merchant princes. Finding the truth is one thing. Finding the truth and staying alive is like a whole other thing. So make sure to check out The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan on sale May 7th. And thanks again to TorBooks for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant rivals to lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode.
This one's kind of a weird pick because it's not actually a thing. It's more of, I'm blending a couple of things together. I have always thought that the short stories, the Eatonville stories of Zora Neale Hurston would make for a wonderful anthology kind of a show. But then I started, because the Gilded Six books, there's really good stuff. The dialogue crackles, there's stakes, and the setting is wonderful. And then I got thinking about Zora Neale Hurston's own life. And I wonder if like a biopic that blends a little bit of fiction and nonfiction kind of in together as she, like, she lied a lot about herself. Like Dust Tracks on the Road, her memoir, is largely unreliable. And I wonder if there's some kind of metafictional, metatextual thing you could do with her ethnography, her own fiction, and her own life, and kind of blend it up into a Hurstonia kind of a catalog. That would be a, you know, I'm not really sure beyond that, but where each episode, I'm thinking a series of some kind, a limited series, where each episode takes a story and then connects it to something else that's going on with her. She became an investigative reporter and got involved in like this crime later on that she was trying to cover and solve at the same time. There's just a lot. There's so much there that I'm not even sure. You'd have to pick a thread and weave it. But we've tried Their Eyes Were Watching God several times. I'm not actually sure Their Eyes Were Watching God is the best film material that Hurston has made. And I think her own life is way more interesting. You know, she's the first first black woman to be a PhD student at Columbia University. She's in the Harlem Renaissance, but then she's motoring around Florida in her convertible with Langston Hughes. They have a falling out. She goes to Jamaica to write Their Eyes Were Watching God in 6 weeks. She dies in this pauper's grave. Only to be discovered by Alice Walker, you know, her grave to be discovered sort of unmarked by Alice Walker, Walker famously much later. I feel like there's something there. So someone do something with that, because there's a whole mess of interesting junk that could be put in, not junk, a whole of material that could be, I don't know. I think there's something that could be really fascinating and maybe almost like an orchid thief kind of a way, like what Susan Orlean did with, Charlie Kaufman did with Susan Orlean's Orchid Thief, where some of the historiography and research and the writing could get mixed up in the story. So anyway, that's my second. That's my kind of wild card. I want the interesting mess, postmodernist mess kind of person. This is not the kind of thing Hulu's going to bankroll, but maybe someone will if we get down to more artsy streaming services. I'm not sure who would bankroll this. Maybe Shonda in her billion-dollar Netflix deal could like roll this as like pick number 9 of 14 or something like that.
Doesn't Criterion have some sort of streaming situation that feels kind of?
They do. Are those originals though? I mean, I don't know. I thought those were just taking like the artsy fartsy stuff collector's editions.
Do originals?
Out of it.
They could do it.
Yeah.
For this.
Sure. Okay. Fine.
Yeah.
It's Criterion then. Thank you. Yeah. Great.
I kind of want a similar thing for When Women Were Birds. Like, it would need to leave storytelling and some of the other stuff.
You're up.
Next one. Okay. The Wangs versus the World by Jade Chang.
Good one.
Good one.
I can see this existing tomorrow.
Right? I'm kind of surprised it doesn't already. I love a road trip setup. And the setup of this story is this family, the father built a cosmetics empire. They've had a huge fortune, but then the financial crisis of 2008 happens and he's lost everything. And in the beginning, he's bringing the kids home from college to tell them, like, you can't go here anymore because we don't have any money. And also we have to pack up the one remaining car that wasn't repossessed. And of course it's like the crappy car. And they're going to drive across the country from Bel Air to upstate New York to live at the family's oldest daughter has a successful career and her own home. And so the rest of the family is going to drive across the country and live there. And it's like a Schitt's Creek kind of vibe, I think, but super high end. And they stop places along the way because they've got to go all the way from Bel Air to New York. And there is a lot of drama and a lot of comedy. And I think I think you could do it as a series. I could see the temptation to make it a series, but I think it would be better as a nice, tight, 90-minute to 2-hour movie that just like hit all of the big notes and let it be funny and thoughtful and didn't try to like string it out too much.
That's good.
But I really loved reading it when I read it, and I would love to watch it.
A madcap romp. That's good. We need some more of those.
Love a romp.
I don't really have anything funny on my list now that I look at it again. I guess if we go on the romp kind of a vibe, this is a darker true crime romp. But The Billion Dollar Whale is a nonfiction book. And it's about the main person, it's not a character, it's a real person. His name is Joe Blow, which is incredible. And it's about him being an outsider in America, going to Penn and remaking himself into a wheeler dealer at the highest stakes of getting involved with like sovereign wealth funds in Saudi Arabia. And it's a giant pyramid scheme and, convincing Deutsche Bank to do all this stuff that's really, really illegal and defrauding the Malaysian sovereign front out of more than $1 billion. And I think even right now, I think this is right. Google this for me. Right now, he lives on a yacht circling international waters because as soon as he lands anywhere, he gonna get picked up.
I just had images of Mark Watney going, I'm a space pirate.
I'm a space pirate. No, he's a real pirate. And it intersects with celebrities. Like he hires, can't remember. He hires
It's a bonker
these, like,
story.
He hires, like, it's not Britney Spears, but it's someone like that to appear at his birthday party. He gets involved in bankrolling the Wolf of Wall Street, becomes not a friend of Leonardo DiCaprio, but like, I don't know, in the circle, in the orbit of these movie producers that are always looking for dumb money, frankly, right? Like people who want to be wheelers and dealers have money, but no access. It was an incredible book. Clint and I both really, when I read it, I immediately passed it on to him. And it's one of those, that goes into the pile of things that I've learned as I become an adult, that there's a lot less holding this world together than you would think. Because if someone like this can do stuff like this at this level, you don't want to think about it too hard, because this is what we know about. Think of what we don't know about. But that's I think it would be an awesome, I think it's a movie. I think it maybe is best served as, I don't think you want like a spotlight vibe. You know, you don't want that sort of dour seriousness, because ultimately you're defrauding sovereign wealth funds, like, which isn't great, who are sometimes, you know, in Malaysia exploiting their people. But like one of the big marks here was Saudi Arabian sheiks who have all this oil money. Like, no one's going to feel bad for that. So the stakes are pretty low in that regard. So I think actually kind of a Wolf of Wall Street vibe might be the right thing to sort of,
I think so,
exuberate, to coin a phrase, in the bawdiness, the tawdriness, and the outright outlandishness. Someone would get an Oscar nomination for playing Joe Blow in a film. I'm just putting that out there right now. So there we go. That's The Billion Dollar Whale.
I listened to that. I think I listened to that like a few years ago, probably right at the same time that you were recommending it to Clint. And it was about the same time that the Crazy Rich Asians movie had come out. Mm. And I realized that my brain sort of merged. There's a really wild bachelor party like on a giant shipping boat that happens, and I realized that my brain sort of merged the parties that Joe Blow would throw with the image of the, that bachelor party in Crazy Rich Asians, and it seems like that's believable.
Let me shout the authors. I forgot to do it. Tom Wright and Bradley Hope were the reporters who turned that reporting into the book Billion Dollar World. Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, that's like truly an eye-popping story. That's a good pick.
Yeah.
My next one is The Woman Next Door by Yoande Antoso. I think for me, this would ring my like Grace and Frankie kind of vibe. Mm. It's set in Johannesburg, South Africa. It's in like a ritzy suburb. And these two older women, I believe they're in their 70s or 80s, are enemies and have been like sworn enemies for decades. One of them is black and the other one is white. And through a series of events, they end up having to spend a lot of time together and they become friends. And it's really funny and heartwarming. I remember pitching it as like the Golden Girls Get Woke a couple years back. They deal with race in a way that is organic to what happens when people of different races and experiences are forced together and have to like deal with each other and ultimately understand each other differently and become often friends. It's lovely and fun and warm, and I would like it as a Netflix series.
Mm. Yes, I like that. I like that very much. Do I have anything warm? Boy, no, I don't. I definitely nowhere warm to go here. Well, my warmest one, and I have one sort of fantasy pick. I think the Darker Shade of Magic series by V.E. Schwab should be a trilogy of movies. The world building is wonderful. It lends itself, even the cover design reflects, you know, some of the world building, the very, you know, very stark red and blacks that go into it. I think it's a complication. You know, the phrase grown-up Harry Potter is overused. I hate to do it except to say that a lot of the things we like about the Harry Potter series in general don't age great in putting aside her stuff, but like the world building and the magic and then the camaraderie inside of it, right? Like this is what you want out of Lord of the Rings, kind of what you want out of Hunger. Like you come for the fantasy, but you stay for the relationships, right? And this does this very well, very interesting characters. Basically, I'm not going to do a good job of summarizing without giving any away, so I'm going to try not to. But there's like sort of there's three universes that are not dissimilar to our own, and it takes place mostly in London. And you can go between, only certain people can go between the universes, these different Londons. But the Londons have different levels of sort of magic in the world, right? And so the main kind of meta story is about pulling from the more magical universe into the less magical universes, right? So it's kind of like extracting, and there's chaos involved in all of it. But there's a central relationship that is really, really good. Anti-heroes, borderline characters of all kinds, and really unusual fantasy, an unusual fantasy vibe. Not that I'm the biggest fantasy reader in the world, but I think it would have great potential to be a very striking moving and epic series. I think this isn't a show. I think you want a movie for each book, and you make them into a couple, a few tentpoles. So that's a Darker Shade of Magic series by V.E. Schwab. That's my franchise.
That's your
pick,
big one,
I guess. All right. That's my franchise pick.
I don't have a series pick.
Well, I win then. Okay, let's wrap this up. We're done. No.
Well, early in 2020, in a time that feels like it was a completely different year from now, I read We Ride Upon Styx by Quan Berry. And I think this is a Hulu joint. It's an anthology series.
Yeah, nice.
The setup of the book is it's the 80s. You're in a suburb of Salem, Massachusetts. The girls' field hockey team at this high school is tired of having losing seasons. So they make a deal with the devil by writing their names in a notebook that has Emilio Estevez's face on it because it's the 80s. And that's how they're going to get their winning season. And it works. Like, there's a little accidental witchcraft that happens. But there's also great pop culture references, and the characters are diverse. In many senses, there are girls of different races. There are girls of different sexual orientations. It's a, like, you could have a really great representative cast. And the book is already set up where we move between the different characters' perspectives, but the story is told with a plural collective narrator. So you could have one episode about each girl or from each girl's perspective. And meantime, through the whole thing, one of the girls is auditioning to play Tituba in a school production of The Crucible. So you're also getting the background of, like, the original story of the Salem witch trials and hysteria and what's happening there. It's really funny and really smart. And I would just love to see it. I think it would be a ton of fun.
It's weird. It's like the vibe is kind of like Dawson Creek meets The Watchmen, the series that we saw. Because you've got, like, this real, like, historical background, but, like, these teenage things layered on top of it. I think that's a really cagey pick, Rebecca.
And I think if they set it in the 80s and, like, were true to where the book is set, you would get great wardrobe and you'd get great music and pop culture references. And it would be fun for people our age to watch and see those things. And equally fun for, like, today's teenagers to watch and imagine the kinds of things that they would, like, cast their spells in their notebooks for.
Yeah, I think that probably of the things we've said so far has, like, the biggest hit potential, like things that other people than us would be interested in, even if you care nothing about the book. I think I'm going to use as a segue, I think I've got one hit pick that I think this is an HBO joint. And I can't believe it doesn't already exist, but Zone One by Colson Whitehead should be a series. I don't know why it's not. He was ahead, shockingly, Colson Whitehead was ahead of the game about thinking about these mixed blended genre situations. He's done that from the very beginning. This is the story. It's set in New York after a pandemic has devastated the planet. And humanity's basically, like, there's zombies and then there's people that haven't become zombies. And this little, the titular Zone One is this piece of the tip of Manhattan that has rallied. And they're trying to clear the city of the zombies. And the main character's job is basically a sweeper, right? To go through and, clear out the city. And then things go bad from there. So we start out after the apocalypse, but then, we enter this new normal. And I really like this genre of post-apocalyptic, again, I've relatively get post-pandemic, post-catastrophe. Apocalypse means there's nothing left. These post-catastrophes where you enter the world after the thing, as they're dealing with the thing, and then something happens. So, like, it's a Big Mac, right? There's two layers of catastrophe sandwiched into one series. I think it would lend itself to, like, some sort of, like, Denis Villeneuve or Ridley Scott kind of beautiful, barren, tensely spare rendition, and I think would be much watched television on an HBO released once a week. I think it could get there. This is my hit pick. Rebecca, what do you think about that?
I think that's a great pick. And I wonder if it would just be seen as, like, trying to compete with The Walking Dead, which somehow is still a big deal.
Yeah, right. But you're right. Maybe that's why. Yeah,
but
maybe.
I don't think that that's a good reason. I think Zone One should exist as a
situation. We've got room for all the zombies. There's room for more than one zombie.
I totally agree.
The tone was so different than Walking Dead, the little I know of Walking Dead, I should say, which is very much like zombie movie. This is much more like, I'm trying to think of a good example. Like, it's like The Road, in which a lot of the time you don't even see the things, right? It's like, it's not out there as much. It's not aliens or something like that.
It's not action-y. It's not like, here's the big scene of running away from the zombie and fighting the zombie and your heart is pounding. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's more existential.
Right. So that's my, I think that would have a chance to be a bona fide hit somewhere, where the rest of these, I think, are sort of like, what would I like to see? Rather than if I was in development for HBO and my job depended on it. I'm not sure I'm picking the Zora Neale Hurston metafictional anthology series. I'm not sure about that one.
Although that might be like the most Jeff O'Neill desire ever.
Look.
Neale Hurston, yeah. Look, I'm into it.
I don't know what else to tell you here. So anyway, all right, where are you? Let's do a couple more.
Okay.
We're going to start running long here.
Yeah, I think I have one more that might be a big hit sort of along those lines, and it's Shadow Shaper by Daniel Jose Holder.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised this isn't a show already either, frankly.
Yeah, set in Brooklyn, about a teenage girl who learns that she comes from a line of shadow shapers, which are people that can like make magic out of and through art, through music and painting and other forms of art. Mostly it's music and like painting and big murals in the book. And it could just be so visually stunning, I think, and would also be really fun to watch, would be a great cast. You know, like, it's set in a Brooklyn that looks the way Brooklyn actually looks, with people of all different races and backgrounds. There's a nice sort of multicultural, like, Bruja witchy thing that's going on with her. And Older has such a great talent for writing dialogue. The dialogue in his stories and his characters' voices are always just really like spot on and believable, and you can picture those people. And I think it would be really fun to watch Shadow Shaper on screen. And also, your all-time pick for films like this, Zendaya, would be a great cast.
As
the main character.
Yeah, I think of the things we've mentioned, well, maybe the darker shade of magic with this one, a visual medium would give you the most value add, right? They're so visually, the visuals are so important that I think that would lend itself extremely well to film. Yeah, that's a really good pick. I'm gonna wind up.
Today's episode is brought to you by Greenleaf Book Group. No summer vacation should be without a great read, and I don't know about you, but I am partial to mysteries and thrillers for my hot month reads. It's hot girl reading summer always over here. And from the award-winning librettist of Legally Blonde, the musical, and the screenwriter of Freaky Friday, Heather Hawke, comes the page-turning psychological thriller, The Trouble with Drowning. So when author Eden Hart floats into Tucson's Antigone Books in all her dazzling perfection to give a reading, Kat, a struggling writer, can't help but compare herself. Thankfully, Kat's life starts to take on its own Eden-like glow when her literary future takes shape and she falls madly in love with Jacob. As demons from her past begin to surface, Kat's mental health craters, and this halcyon dream slips through her fingers. For the fastest-paced, slow burn you won't be able to put down, be sure to check out The Trouble with Drowning by Heather Hawke on Amazon or your retailer of choice. And thanks again to Greenleaf Book Group for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
I got two left I want to talk about. I guess I'll do my penultimate one. My last one is a always already request that will shock no one or that's listened to us over time. But the one before that, and maybe there's already something out there. I didn't go do my, but She Said by Cantor and Tooley. I don't know why this isn't a movie already. Like, we talked about this when we read it for this podcast and talked about it together. It's ready. It's there to be the All the President's Men of the Me Too movement, which, this is a weird side, seems like 1,000 years ago, actually. So I don't know if that's part of it, like it now seems like a historical piece. Fine, let it be a historical piece. Like, one of the things that's hard to remember about All the President's Men is how hard upon the heels of Watergate that movie was, how fast it came out. And Spotlight 2, for that matter, though I think that was maybe 15 years later. So maybe we're in sort of an uncanny valley of interest in She Said, where it's not so close that it's a hot button issue, but it's not far away enough that it's kind of like, it would be like a historical document. So maybe we need a little bit more time, but we've got the reporters, we've got famous names, we've got cloak and dagger kind of stuff about who's going to say what to whom, we've got a villain. I think it would be tremendous. I think it would be one of the tremendous adaptations in the ranks of journalism on film, and not for nothing, by and about and for a predominantly women's cause, which we don't, to my knowledge, there aren't a lot of these. I'd be love to know if you're wrong. If you got a pick, shoot me an email, podcast@bookriot.com. One of my favorite movie genres is the journalism movie. But I think I need this. We need this. This should exist. Mm-hmm. This would be great. There'd be wonderful starring turns for whoever would play Cantor and Tooley. Maybe you could get Gwyneth to play herself, would be a weird moment, but I would be here for that in its own way. So I don't know, maybe that would be maybe that was zone one, feel like to me, you know, the most raring to go, and fits neatly into people's pre-existing categories of what these things are. But that's She Said by Jodi Cantor and Megan Tooley. Lay, want to do a last one? Couple last ones? What do you want to make sure you get into the ether before we get out of here?
A couple last ones. All right. One is The City of Girls by Elizabeth Gilbert. I think this is a glittering HBO joint, kind of in the vein of Boardwalk Empire.
Right.
Period piece. It's 1930s and 40s, New York. Maybe a little bit earlier than that. I didn't Google. But a young woman has gotten kicked out of college and her parents have sent her to live in the city with her aunt for some reason to get her stuff together. Her conservative parents think that she's going to, you know, I don't know what they think is going to happen with her aunt in the city. But her aunt runs this very shabby, run down, like no one knows really how it stays open, playhouse. And while she is living there, she meets these fascinating people, artists and actors. She encounters gay people for the first time, and she comes to understand her own life and her own sexuality in a very freeing, liberating, exciting way. And there's a frame story of her granddaughter, I believe, learning this story much, much later. About what, I think her name is Vivian, about what her life was really like. The casting would be fun. You'd have a huge ensemble, interesting cast. I like a New York set piece. I really like a New York in the 1940s set piece with champagne. I think I saw Elizabeth Gilbert say in an interview one time, or maybe it was a blurb in the book, that she wanted the experience of reading the book to feel like drinking a glass of champagne, to just feel bubbly and luxurious. And that was definitely the experience that I had of it. And it's also sort of subtly political and subtly progressive in the ways that it presents some of the characters and how they come to understand their identities and who they are in the world. And I just think it would be great to see on screen. You could do it as a movie, but I would really like it as an HBO situation.
Speaking of set pieces that we like to see, we both like campus novels.
Oh yeah.
And this goes almost into the RSTLNE Wheel of Fortune, take it as read category for me. I think you and I have talked about this before. Our great friend and colleague Liberty Hardy has talked about it before.
I know what you're going to say, and it's on my list.
It is. Maybe we should end here. It's The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which, look, I don't want to tell anyone how to do their jobs, but you all have done terrible that this doesn't exist as a thing. There's enough imitators in the world of books to try, you know, I won't name names, but like the secret history. It's like we use this as a read-alike. It would be wonderful on screen. Mm-hmm. Star turns for everyone involved. It has the thing we were talking about before. It's not just a Campus novel. It's got a shiv in the middle of it. It's like think Dead Poets Society, but Robert Sean Lennon kills Cameron in the middle of it. Like, that's what we're talking about here. Right, that's what we're talking about. A dark Dead Poet Society.
Mm-hmm.
Here for it, it would look great. Yes. It would also be an 80s period piece at this point, right? I think this is set in the mid 80s, so it would have its own like New England campus 80s, like where the Breakfast Club kids go, like where Molly Ringwald went to college after the Breakfast Club is kind of where like the Wellesleys of the world. It's supposed to be. It's called Hamden, which is based on Bennington, which is just insert New England college, and you know what I'm talking about, Bennington. I want this tomorrow. Can we kickstart? What do we got to do here? I don't understand. We've been waiting for this for a long time.
When we hang up, I'm going to Google, because there has to be some story about why this isn't a movie yet. It just feels to me like there has to be a reason. I think it could be, when I was thinking about it for today, I think it could be the 80s set piece, or you could update it for 2020. Like,
you could. I have spent
some time in Bennington in the very recent past, because I have friends who live up there and teach at Bennington. And the cast of the book is super white. The population of Bennington is less white now and is more diverse in many ways and pretty interesting. And there's still like that New England winter where dark things happen. And that's a large driving force of the story. But like Bennington now also has like a pretty strong drug culture that makes things interesting and that would fit into sort of those like Bacchanalia moments that happen when they're trying to like conjure stuff.
Liberal arts colleges of all stripes are recruiting more diversely now. There's no reason all these white characters can, I mean, Zendaya can play two or three characters as far as I'm concerned in this. Kind of do a Tom Hardy situation. Try to play a few of them. I don't care. Let's go.
Bunny could be a girl. Yeah.
There you go.
And, you know, it isn't, now that I'm saying it out loud, though, I do think it might make more sense to set it in the 80s, because the relationship that they have with their professor in this story is not really something that we could sell as super likely to happen in 2020, where it was totally believable in that 80s set piece. I would love for this to be a movie. It really needs to happen.
I think a series. It's long. Make it True Detective. True Detective 101. AP True Detective Honors True Detective is what we're doing here. And so this one needs to be a miniseries so much it makes me actually angry. Like, I don't enjoy this conversation we're having. Like, I'm just mad.
It has the feel of something that like you would pick a weekend to rewatch it every winter, or on this first snowfall.
I mean, I guess to take the other side, which is wrong, but just for a moment, because I'm generous intellectually like that, it might be that between Talented Mr. Ripley, Dead Poets, School Ties, I mean, there's a genre here. It's not quite like this in a lot of ways. I'm wondering if it's, you know, I'm getting but at. Maybe it's too crowded. Maybe it's too crowded.
I think it was too crowded 15 or 20 years ago, but it's not too crowded now. Like, we aren't getting 80s college and boarding school movies now, and a good one would be awesome.
I don't understand. I really don't understand why we don't get more TV shows set in college. I don't understand. It's wonderful storytelling environment. Like, we get high school and we get right out of college. But college is wild, man. You know about colleges. People are trying to figure out what they're doing. There's fish out of water. They're trying to figure out who they are. They're trying multiple different things. The stakes are high, but not necessarily, you know, it doesn't have to be life or death, right? People of different backgrounds thrown together. I really don't know why there aren't more really wonderful college series. I can't, who has the belt right now for the best college series? Felicity? Oh, I mean, geez, come on, I can't be Felicity, can it?
Well, there is that one season of Dawson's Creek where they're in college.
That's terrible. The Saved by the Bell. See, was there a Saved by the Bell?
There was. Saved by the Bell, the college years.
Look, we are just proving the case that this is a horribly, horribly undermined territory. In the secret history, it's there. It's just sitting there. Maybe Tart doesn't want to. I mean, this stuff happens, right? She doesn't want to give up the rights. Someone has the rights, and they're sitting on it. You know, these things happen. But we built the Aswan High Dam. We can make a version of the secret history.
Yeah, I'm gonna do some Googling. We're gonna find out. Put on my detective cap. Figure it out.
All right, I think that's our show. Any last shouts? Any half baked adaptation ideas? Things you rejected from your list that not on the main list? They're honorable mentions.
I really want to watch an adaptation of Weather by Jenny Offel, starring Laura Linney.
And it's just her sitting around with rubber ducks and sitting at a library desk thinking about stuff.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, being existential. And I want some kind of adaptation of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone by Lori Gottlieb that does like an interesting thing with people in therapy and also the therapist in therapy. And I think this is really just because I'm mad that the great Gabrielle Byrne series In Treatment got canceled too soon a few years ago.
You see they're rebooting that with a black woman in the Byrne spot? Did you see that?
No.
I don't remember the actress's name.
That's exciting. I'm going to Google that now, too. I loved that series. I love therapy as a set piece for TV, especially. And it's not done that often. And when it is done, it's not often done that well. Like, I think The Sopranos did it well and In Treatment did it well. And that's about as far as I've gotten.
I'm not sure that this, my last one, I'm not sure that it would make for a very good adaptation. It's one of those I kind of want to see. And it would be, maybe it's a better play. Because the cast of characters rather sparse, but The Street by Ann Petrie centers on a black woman in the 40s, Ann Petrie herself, writing somewhat from experience, trying to make it, you know, as a working class woman, and in that period of time, still today, frankly, underrepresented in all genres, but then it was way ahead of her time. Mm. And it would be, you know, it'd almost be best as like a Telluride Film Festival indie movie where you get a big actress. And you package it up kind of like they did for Renee Zellweger with Judy. Like the point of that is try to get Renee Zellweger an Oscar, right? Like that's kind of the point of that movie. We don't do that enough for people of color. Let's do that. And Ann Petrie, The Street is ready there. It's a great role for someone. Off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly how old she is. I do this thing now. And probably I always did it once I was like out of college age where every character that I'm not sure how old they are, I just assume is 5 years older than I am. Right. But I'm getting to the point now where that's probably unlikely for these kinds of she's not 48. She's not 47 in this, but she's probably like 25. So maybe that's Janelle Monáe gets a lot of these kinds of historical period pieces role. I'm not sure this is quite right for her. Zendaya is probably a little too young, but I don't know. Casting and everything, you know, that Occam's razor of casting for me right now. But this would be a wonderful set piece for someone. And you'd get wonderful production design and so on and so forth. So I don't know that it's going to be a smash hit that a streaming service is going to pick up. But writer-director who has a good relationship with an actress who wants to take it her shot at getting one of those little gold statues, Ann Petrie, The Street, is sitting there waiting for you.
Excellent.
All right. That was super fun. We've got more of these. We can do future iterations of this one because I got more. You got more.
Yep.
Yeah. We didn't even try. That's what you want your audience to hear, right? Didn't even try in preparation for the show. They've dedicated an hour or two.
No. It's just that easy. We're just that good.
Yeah. We make it look easy. Yeah. There you go. Speaking of, while we're in adaptation, we're talking about it. I don't, by Thursday, who knows if we'll remember, but Fare Thee Well to the King of All Make It Look Easy actors, Sean Connery. You heard us talk about Hunt for October, Marco Ramius, hot take, a better literary adaptation character than James Bond for Connery. You heard it here first and probably last. No one else. Maybe me and Amanda have that take, that Ramius is a more interesting and cool character than James Bond. But a pretty good bona fides. There's story. I'll try to find it for show notes. I don't know that it's linkable. But he gave an interview to the Houston Chronicle a long time ago about a mentor that gave him books to read while he was on set and traveling the world that kind of changed Sean Connery's life. So a reader himself, Anyway, it's, you know, whatever. It's Connery. It's sort of related to this. One of my favorite. I mean, who doesn't like Sean Connery? I mean, good Lord. Seemed like an all-around good guy, even if he played people you wouldn't maybe want to be around after a couple of cocktails sometimes. But fare thee well. Go. You can listen to me and Amanda talk about our great love for The Hunt for Red October, which is only great because of Sean Connery. I mean, that's not true, but he really is the center of that show. And the center of him is his hairpiece, which I always tell people anytime it comes up, cost $20,000. $20,000 hairpiece for Sean. And that's $1990. We're not even accounting for inflation.
Well, thank you for spending this hour of pleasant distraction with me. Thank you.
It did listeners. Kill an hour. It did kill an hour of our election day. So that's not that's not for nothing.
You know what, Anna? May our efforts succeed.
May our efforts succeed. We'll talk to you next time, Rebecca.